We are just coming up on 7:30, so I will go ahead now and mute all. And if you unmute yourself, please remute yourself after you make a comment or question, so we keep background noise to a minimum. And later on this evening, as always, due to Alan's hard work, the deck in PDF format, as well as contents of the chat window and the audio track will be available on our website. And welcome all. If we have any new people with us tonight, welcome to the Ottawa PC User Group. And as always, we welcome guests at any time at our meetings. You can come as many times as you want. If you do want to join, I have pasted into the chat how you can go, the link to where you can go to join the group. And if you miss that in the chat, just go to our homepage and click on the join or renew link at the top. And it's just $20 a year to join our happy little band. And with that, I will stop the advertisements and kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris, and good evening, everyone. I think we're going to have time tonight for some questions at the end, so put your thinking caps on. But in the meantime, we have quite a few topics prepared, so we'll go through those starting now. So first up, if you're bugged with these, going to websites and seeing these messages that you have to accept or decline or modify your preferences in terms of what cookies you would like or not. This article from, I think it was an article on PC Magazine, and we talked about it last week, that Brave has a feature now. The Brave browser, web browser, has a feature which they call Cookie Crumbler, and it automatically deals with these pop-up messages, so you actually don't see them. And one of the questions was, well, what happens to the cookies? Does Brave get rid of them, or does it accept them all? And what in fact happens? So I thought I would go on to Perplexity and essentially ask it, you know, does it reject or does it accept them all? And basically it says it doesn't do either. It just blocks the pop-up message so that you don't have to deal with it. And so I don't know what happens to the cookies. I guess you probably don't get them. Or maybe you do. Kind of an interesting question, isn't it? I don't actually know. But you don't see the pop-ups, so that's a good thing. Okay, something else we had was, there was some discussion in the, there was a question in terms of at the end, we didn't have time to deal with, was whether you should be turning off your computer overnight or leaving it on. And what are the benefits and what are the downsides of doing both of these things? And there were some comments in the chat. There were some comments in the chat, and Harvey said, it's recommended to restart at least once a week just to basically clean things up. And he chooses to shut down every day, basically so that he's not wearing out the hard drive and the memory and basically to maintain the parts of the computer as long as possible. And Tom suggested that if you're going to leave the PC on, then you should turn the internet access off, basically to protect yourself from hackers who are trying to break in. The machine doesn't have internet access, and the hackers have no pathway inboard when you're not there. And Tim suggested that if you turn the laptop off every night, then you're going to get longer battery life out of a laptop. So again, I went on to Perplexity and asked it the same kind of question, and it gave me a whole bunch of things here. You can certainly save power, you save electricity if you turn the thing off. However, it's much less convenient because now you have to wait for it to boot up. But of course, if you're using a solid state drive, it boots up in, you know, tens of seconds, so it's not really a big deal. However, if the machine's off, then anything that would run in the background, such as you know, backup programs that run at 3 o'clock in the morning, if the computer's off, then that backup is not going to occur. And similarly with if you have scheduled updates and security scans, then they would not run if it was turned off. So clearly, either schedule your background task for a different time, or you're going to have to leave the machine turned on. And the component longevity, that was Harvey's point, keeps things running longer. And Tom's point about security and disconnecting from the internet to reduce cyber threats. And noise and distraction. You don't get noise or light from your PC if it's turned off, especially if it's in a bedroom. And then finally, Perplexity said, the environmental impact, that you can minimize that by reducing the energy consumption and cooling and that kind of stuff. It's a bit like the energy savings one at the front end there. And there were some additional notes. If you want to use sleep or hibernate, it's kind of a compromise. You save some energy, but you do get a quick resume. Organizational solutions, you can play with the power management settings to work the way that you want the thing to do. And there's that Tim's point about laptops benefiting more and saving battery life. So I don't know whether, Chris, you had any additional thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. One of the things was Harvey talked about shutting down to clean up. You end up rebooting Windows, and so it cleans up everything. And one thing to be cautious about with that is if you go into Control Panel, Power Options, and if you click on Define Power Buttons and what they do, there is a Shutdown Settings section. And the first option on that is Turn On Fast Startup Recommended, and it is usually on by default. And you have to watch for that, because if you have that turned on, the way it works is if you actually then do a shutdown, you're not actually going to clean up memory, because what happens is it closes all your programs, logs you out, then it writes the current state of memory of Windows and drivers and everything else to the hibernation file. And then it shuts down. And then when it starts up, it reads that hibernation file back into memory. So you end up with the exact same state for Windows itself, not any of your running programs. And then it presents you with the login screen. So if you are in the habit of shutting down in order to clean up memory, you're not actually doing it if Turn On Fast Startup is actually enabled. If you turn that off, then Windows will completely shut down, and when it starts up, it has to read all its files into memory and so forth as a standard startup. So be a little careful about that. The other thing that I will say is, and there's some people that are talking in the chat about cyber threats, if the computer is left running and in sleep mode. So typically in sleep mode, you're not going to have any issues with being attacked or anything like that. But the other thing that some people seem to think that, well, if your computer is turned off when you're sleeping or whatever, then it's not going to be attacked. My counter to that is that your computer has to be resilient enough to withstand any attacks while you're using it. So it's going to be just as resilient when you're not using it and you're sleeping. So, I think that idea gives you a false sense of security if you're shutting down your computer purely from the point of view of trying to resist attacks. Just keep in mind, your computer has to be resilient while you're using it. It'll be just as resilient when you're not using it. So those are the my only comments to it, I guess, on that. There, Tom talks about memory leaks and some things like that. It would clean up those. Again, memory leak, if you have fast shutdown or fast startup enabled and you just do a shutdown, you're going to get the exact same state of memory for Windows itself, but you will clean up any memory leaks that are from user applications running. So that's a benefit for sure. I'm just trying to see if, Alan, do you see anything else in there? That
Natalie's asking, how do you know if fast startup is enabled?
Yeah, go to control panel. And so you probably don't have an icon for it. So you just click on start, type in control. It'll come up and go for it. And then go to power options. And in the left-hand panel, define power buttons. I think is the way it's worded. Let me just see. Oh, choose what the power buttons do is the option. And then at the bottom of that dialog box, there's four options about sleep, hibernate, lock, whether they're enabled or disabled. And then there's at the top of that list is turn on fast startup. And they say it's recommended. It will definitely on spinning hard drives. It will make it faster to do a startup. But if you're on an SSD, it's probably minimal difference on it. And I actually always disable that just so that when I do a shutdown, it does a complete shutdown. It doesn't write the current state to the hibernation file. And when it starts up, it really, really does read all of the files for Windows itself, all of the drivers, has to read them from disk into memory and gets you a really fresh configuration.
So there's a follow-up question there in terms of, is that the case for Windows 10?
And, yes.
And Tom's saying he thinks it goes back to Windows XP.
It could be. It definitely is in 10. I know that for sure. It is a choice, and it's certainly if you're on a spinning hard drive, it can make a difference in how fast the PC will start up. If you do a shutdown, it will start up a lot faster reading that hibernation file rather than reinitializing Windows from all its myriad files.
And Natalie says she sees the checkbox in Windows 10, but it's grayed out and she can't uncheck it.
You probably have to go to the top of that dialog box where it says change settings that are currently unavailable. And if you actually click on that, you should be able to actually change that, turn on fast startup.
Well, do you have to be an administrator or something?
Nope. And Natalie just said, yes, thanks.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thanks very much for all that. And next up, we have Chris talking about Dave's Garage.
Yeah, Dave's Garage, it's a really interesting channel on YouTube. Dave Plummer is a retired operating system programmer from Microsoft, and he has a really balanced way of viewing things. He does like Windows for sure, but he has no reservation about tearing a strip off of Microsoft when they deserve it. And so this one that just came out the other day, Microsoft's Dirty Secret, Your Old PC is Now Trash, he talks about this idea of what the requirements for Windows 11, the hardware requirements, in particular he talks about the Trusted Platform Module, TPM 2.0, as being a requirement, as well as Secure Boot. He also talks a little bit about the CPU requirements, but he really concentrates on the TPM and Secure Boot requirements for it. And he does go into some detail about it, and he does ask the question, you know, has your perfectly good technology prematurely been relegated to sidelines? Because, you know, you can be using a computer that it works fine. It could, performance-wise, Windows 11 would be able to run on it fine, but because of this requirement for TPM 2.0, all of a sudden you're stuck at Windows 10, which is about to have end of life. And then he also asks the question, you know, have you actually tried bypassing the requirement checks for TPM and the CPU, which there are workarounds for that right now. And he does do a little bit of a caution on it. He says it's crucial to really understand what the potential downsides and the risks of doing those bypasses of TPM and CPU, what they really mean. And he doesn't say one way or the other that you should either do it or not do it, but he says that it really is an individual user has to make that choice about whether they're going to bypass those checks. But he gives you a little bit of background information, and I think it's one of the best explanations I've heard of what the TPM actually does and what Secure Boot actually does and what it brings to the table from a security point of view. He also points out that, yeah, there's a lot of talk about the fact that this is, you know, driving sales of new PCs, which, you know, all of Microsoft's partners love and so forth. And there's conspiracy theorists who think that that's all it's all about. Anyhow, I think it's a really good video, and so I highly recommend that people, especially on Windows 10 machines that maybe can't be upgraded to Windows 11, take a look at this and make your decision as to how you want to proceed, as well as make sure you attend Alan's presentation in September on Windows 10 end of life. And that's it.
I have a question, Chris.
Yeah.
If you're not using Windows on a machine at all and you're using Linux, does he say anything about any downside?
No.
Any risk that the TPM and the CPU bypasses are normally for Windows.
Yep. Yeah, the thing about that really comes down to the idea that Windows 11 brings some additional capabilities in terms of security that Windows 10 mm-hmm. doesn't have. Linux, you're basically sitting with the security that Linux is providing you, and there is no version of Linux out there now. He doesn't talk about this, but this is my take on it, is that I don't think there's versions of Linux out there that are taking specific advantage of a TPM or secure boot type of feature. So you're not getting those added benefits necessarily, but it's not to say you're in a bad position. You're just not getting some enhancements that Microsoft is bringing to the table with Windows 11.
Thanks.
I agree, Chris. That was a really good video. I watched it too. And couple of the things I found interesting, and he talked about, you know, the problem of e-waste.
Yeah.
There's something like a billion computers are not going to be upgradable to Windows 11. And what are people going to do with them? And when you looked at the comments, there were hundreds of comments. One that stuck out to me was a guy who said his company was going to trash 3,000 computers,
yeah.
You know, because they couldn't be upgraded. And
yeah.
the other 137 comments were, I switched to Linux a year ago and I'm not looking back. Everything's working fine.
Yeah. I mean, Dave does spend a fair amount of time on the e-waste aspect of it and the fact that, you know, many think that this is unconscionable to force people to discard perfectly good hardware, and he doesn't argue against that idea.
No, like you say, he has a very balanced approach. It's a really good video.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much for that one. So everybody take a look at that video. It's fairly short, but as Chris, it's packed full of really good information.
Okay, and the next one is me too.
Yes, carry on.
Little language lessons. So this is kind of cool. This is brand new from Google. You can see from the URL, it comes from their labs. So it's labs.google. So this is their experimental stuff. But for anybody who's trying to learn a new language, this is kind of neat. And so they actually have three sort of modules, I guess, Tiny Lessons, Slang Hang, and WordCam. And I'll go through what each of those sort of brings to the table. So they go into a little bit of information about the idea that, you know, it isn't all about textbooks and exercises when you're doing learning a new language. And so there's an awful lot of day-to-day way that you talk to other people and things like that that comes into play that maybe isn't covered in traditional study and so forth. So the first one is Tiny Lesson. And so what you do in this is you choose a language. So in this case, I chose French Canada. And then you type in purpose. Now, when you first go to purpose, they actually have a whole bunch of ones that you can just pick from a list. But you can actually type in whatever you want. So I just typed in hiking in the wilderness, and then I click on generate. And it comes up with a dialog box like this where there's three sections, vocabulary, phrases, and tips. And you can sound out each of these. So if you want to, you know, hear how it's pronounced in French, you can actually sound it out. And then on each of those, there's a see more. So you can see at the top there, it came up with, you know, the mountain and it's too small on my screen. Anyhow. The bear. Okay, yeah, I'll make my screen a little bit bigger. You know, and then you can see more words that are related to hiking in the wilderness. So these are, you know, vocabulary that is likely to come up. Then they have the phrases, you know, where's the trail? You know, what is the distance to the summit? You know, different phrases that you may come across in hiking in the wilderness. And then they have this tip section where I didn't go into a lot of detail in the tip section on that. But kind of neat where it sort of, you know, picks out, you know, vocabulary and phrases in particular that you're likely to run into. Slanghang is learning idioms, idiomatic expressions, and things like that. So again, you choose the language, and then you just click on Generate, and then it'll come up with a scenario. And so it just comes up with a paragraph of something, and it'll come up with a person saying something in that particular scenario. And again, you can sound it out if you want. And then you can actually click on that little icon and say, click for translation, and it'll actually translate it for you. And then you also have the press space to continue. And each time you hit the space, it'll alternate between the two people talking back and forth. And so you can just get into this conversation and follow it along and, translate those terms or phrases that you don't know anything about and sound out things. So kind of a neat way to, get more familiar with a particular language. And then there's WordCam. And so, again, you choose the language, then you open camera. And in my case here, I was using my desktop, so I've just got my webcam. I presume that you could actually run this on a laptop and have it, point out at something else. But so this is my computer room. And it identified a number of objects in the room and didn't identify all of them. And it was interesting because some of the other times it picked up the poster that's sort of leaning against the wall in the back and some things like that. But it picked up some things that, you know, like the phone and the backpack and things like that. You can click on any one of them to get more information about that particular object. And so I clicked on my backpack, and so it came up, and it said, okay, it's green, it's big, it's practical, it's durable, and it's new. And so I could go in, and I could get those phrases related to those particular aspects of it. And again, I can sound it out and things like that. So I think it was really kind of neat. And so I recommend anybody who's doing language training of any sort, try it out. You might find it useful. And it's a little bit of a different take on language learning than what I've seen on some other aspects of like Duolingo or something like that. A lot of similarities, but some interesting differences in there as well. So anyhow, check it out.
Okay, thanks, Super. Thank you very much, Chris. Next up, we have a question that came in about the Ontario Public the Ottawa Public Library, and basically how to access ebooks using Windows. I guess everybody probably knows that you can take out ebooks from the library, and generally they're thinking that you have an ebook reader, an Android device or something similar, iPad, I guess. But if you have a regular PC, and you're running or a device that's running Windows, then it's more of a problem, mainly because their main application, which is called Libby, which is an OverDrive app, Libby doesn't have they dropped the Windows version of it a couple of years back. So there is no Windows version of Libby, which gives you a problem. So if you want to read ebooks on the Windows system, then you need to use Adobe Digital Editions. And Orion says that that works well if you have NetFramework 3.5. However, if you're upgrading to Windows 11, then that system comes with Net Framework 4.8, and apparently that I don't have Windows, so I don't have this issue. I don't know what's going on, but apparently it's not working properly. So the question is, how do you access the older Net Framework in Windows 11 without causing all kinds of other problems? And he looked on the web, and it suggested turning off Windows features in Control Panel and selecting Net Framework 3.5. So if anybody has any ideas on this, has done it, knows how to do it, then please let us know, and we'll do a follow-up later on or next week.
We do have a comment in the chat from Tom, saying that Adobe Digital Editions is at 4.5 currently, whether that'll help out. And Natalie says she just logs into Libby on her PC, and she gives a URL there, and she's using Windows 10. Tom says version 4.5 of Digital Editions works in Windows 11 for him on OPL eBooks. So maybe that's all that's required, is actually upgrading to Digital Editions 4.5 and try that out.
Maybe that's true. I'm interested in Natalie's comment. Does that mean are you using a browser to read the book online, or can you download the book and read it offline? Because that's my problem. I want to be able to read books offline.
You can download it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you can do anything. You can do anything that you could do on the app. So you can. I'm assuming that's what I'm doing, because that's how I'm accessing it. So yeah, you just log in, and I have several libraries, not just the OPL, and so it asks you. For your library, you put in your card number, your password, or ID, and then you just go in. So, yeah, that's what I've done.
Okay, so maybe when you log out of the library, the book's still there.
Sorry?
When you log out from the library, the book is still available to you.
Yeah, well, so you have to log in again, but it saves your place, like whether you're... I guess if you sync your devices, it knows where you are. So
sounds like you're reading the book online to me.
I don't know, because I downloaded it on my my tablet.
Yeah, if you wanted to test it, I would say try turning off your Wi-Fi on your tablet, and if you can still access your book, then that's good. If you can't access your book when your Wi-Fi is turned off, then or in your airplane mode or whatever, then you're in a position that Alan doesn't want, which is having to be connected to read the book.
Yeah, on the PC, I'm not sure. On the tablet, because I clicked on download, so I know.
What kind of a tablet is it?
It's the one that I was using was the Samsung.
It's Android.
So, Android, yeah.
Yeah.
See, there is a Libby app for Android, but there isn't a Libby app for Windows. You see, I have a Windows tablet, essentially. I've got a hybrid, and I can use it in tablet mode, but there's no Libby app for it.
Okay. So maybe
Bill says that he uses Libby on his cell phone. Well, I could do that, but I don't want to read ebooks on a tiny little screen either.
It's not actually that bad. If you're used to reading a newspaper, that's what it looks like on your phone, and it's very fast to read. But you do have to get used to it. You may not like it, Alan, but, I got used to it.
I got this nice 10-inch, 11-inch tablet. It works really well. And actually, okay. I figured out how to do it, because this thing is going to have to go to Linux. So now the next problem is, of course, there's no Libby app for Linux either.
But you can get rid of your flip phone, Alan.
You can run Android as a virtual machine and download Libby onto the VM.
You should get rid of your flip phone, Alan.
I could get rid of all kinds of things. I'm not going to.
I was just trying to go to the library, and it looks like you can download something from the Google Play Store. And I was just going to download it on my computer. That's not what you're talking about.
The Play Store is an Android app.
Well, I'm on Windows. What does that mean? So.
Well, Play Store could be a browser extension is what you're downloading.
Yeah, I don't know.
Or is this thing on now?
A lot of confusion, I think.
Okay.
Alan, you could try using the Android emulator BlueStacks for Windows to use the Android. What are we talking about?
Yeah, that's what I'm doing. I'm not using that particular one, but it's an emulator. I think it's Android x86 or something. Same idea.
Sorry. Okay.
Anyway, I'll get back to that because it is a topic that is of interest to me. So we'll take a look at that later on. So talking about the Play Store, Stuart had a thing on the members only forum, which I'll get to right here, and noting that Google has got rid of about half of the apps that used to be in the Play Store, and they've gone from 3.5 million apps in January last year to now about 1.8 million. And the theory is that they got rid of a whole bunch of junk, I guess, or low quality apps, as they call it. So Stuart had given this link here to the Mobile Syrup story about it. So if your favorite app is now missing from the Play Store, this is probably why, or at least it's one of the reasons why. And I actually came across this myself just recently because my wife got a new Android phone. And my wife's a birder, so she has a whole bunch of applications which are meant for birding. So, for example, we've talked about the Merlin Bird ID from Cornell University. And it's a completely free app. It's like a field guide. It has pictures and maps and descriptions and photographs. And it also listens to birdsong and will identify the birds for you from the calls. And it's completely free. So on the new phone, you just download it again and install it. But then we have a couple of apps that we actually bought. One was the Sibley Guide, which is, a true field guide. And it has a lot of illustrations. And one of the good things about this thing is it has illustrations of the birds in all kinds of different plumages. So rather than just seeing them in their best kind of May finery, their breeding plumage, you get all kinds of different plumages to help you identify the birds through the year. This also was an app that we purchased. But in this case, I could download the app from the Sibley website and basically just reinstall it. And I get the old version. I get the version I paid for, not the brand new version. But that's okay because the version we had is good enough. And the third one is the same kind of thing. It's called iBird Pro. It's the same sort of thing. And you might wonder, why do you need all these things? Well, I typically just use Merlin to look at the bird photographs and play the songs to remind me what they sound like, that kind of thing. My wife uses Merlin to listen for the birds and see what's around. And when she's doing that, she can't look at the pictures of the birds that are popping up and she's looking at. So she runs two apps at the same time, one to do the listening and identifying, and the other one to act as an actual field guide for reference. So iBird Pro is her favorite kind of reference app. However, this is one of these apps that's no longer in the Play Store. So I was wondering why that would be, and I did some research on the web, and I came across this first article here from March of 2023, where it indicated that the iBird app wasn't compliant with Google's privacy policies. And apparently Google's tightened up on their policies and insisted that developers had to meet all kinds of requirements, and basically in terms of assuring user privacy from people who use the application. And apparently Agbird didn't comply with this, so it got removed from the Play Store. And the second thing that happened was in August of 23, when iBird Pro, the one that we bought, has now become a subscription-based app. So it's got an annual, or in theory, it's got an annual fee. However, when you go to the iBird Pro website, this is what you see. And I don't know what this means. Thank you for being patient. We'll be back shortly. Well, you know, how short is shortly? I've actually got no idea. So this was a bit of a problem. The app isn't available on the Play Store, so I can't download it. And the site isn't live, so I can't contact the company to ask what's going on. And so I took a look around and did a, you know, what else can I do? And I found this YouTube video, and it basically talks about, this is exactly the situation, that you can't get the app anymore, but you have it on your old phone. How can you transfer it to your new phone? And I didn't know you could actually do this, because, you know, when you install a program on the computer, there's generally a lot of stuff going on, and you can't just take a file, an executable file, and copy it from on the other system that's going to work. However, this guy tells you exactly how to do it, and what he does, he suggests using a third-party file manager, and it's called File Manager Plus. And he's using this for a very specific purpose, I think, because my third-party file manager doesn't quite work the same. But if you need to do this, if you need to transfer a program from one Android device to a second Android device, then you can use this File Manager Plus to do the job. And the way you do it is you install File Manager Plus, and then you, on your old phone, you navigate to the apps category in settings, find the app that you're interested in transferring. In my case, it's this iBird Pro. And you basically press down on the icon and hold it down, which they call a long press. And that pops up a context menu, and in that menu is the option to back up this program. So you choose backup, and then it works its magic and creates the backup. So now you go to your main storage and the backups folder and the app subfolder, and you find this APK file, which is a program, an installation type program for
Android package. Android package, I think.
Yeah, there's a third word in there, so I can't remember what it's called. Anyway, you find this APK file, and that's basically got all the bits and pieces that you need to install the program. So you transfer this file to the second phone. And the guy on the video suggested using Bluetooth just to set up both phones on Bluetooth, pair them together, and then you have a direct connection so you can transfer the file. I actually couldn't get that to work. One of the phones wanted to pair, but the other phone couldn't see the connection. So I actually did it a different way, which I'll talk about in just a second. So then once you've transferred the file onto the new phone, then it's an APK file. You can just click on it and select install, and it will actually transfer the program as an installed application on your new phone. So it works really, really well. So here's what happens. So this is File Manager Plus, and I'm looking at this thing called apps, this category called apps. So I select apps, and then I scroll down until I find my application, and then I do that long press, just press down on the item here, and it pops up this menu down the bottom, and I choose backup. But once I click on backup, then it works its magic. This little progress bar moves across the screen here. It's fairly quick. it's what, 67 megabytes, the file. So it's fairly quick to store that into the system. And when it's finished, it will tell you that the app is the backup is complete, and it tells you where it stored it, and it's in the backups apps folder on my original smartphone. So now I can go into my file manager, go into the main storage, into backups, into apps, and here is this 67 megabyte APK file that we have created. Right, so I couldn't get the Bluetooth to work, but what I did do, I used my my network attached storage. I did an article in the newsletter, and I think I did it for the Q&A session at one point. I plug a micro USB flash drive into the router. Once it's in the router, then it's sitting on the local area network, and my Windows PC, my Android smartphone, and my Windows tablet, they can all see this, and my Linux PC also. Everybody on the network can see this folder on the USB drive plugged into the router. So I basically connect the first phone to it and then transfer the APK file onto the USB drive, and then basically connect the second phone to the folder and download it onto the new phone. So I transfer the APK file from the old phone to the new phone through this network attached USB drive. All right, so once we've got the file transferred to the new phone, so now we're in the downloads folder of the new phone. We have the APK file, so we just have to install it. So we select the program. It pops up this menu, and it says what you want to do. Well, clearly I want to install this program, but it won't let me do it. And again, this is Android at its finest, and the nanny state won't let you do anything these days. And it's because I'm trying to install an application that didn't come from the phone manufacturer or Google Play Store or somewhere authorized. It's coming off the internet, it thinks. It's coming from outside of the phone, and it's really concerned that this might be a threat. However, it says more details. All right, so let's look at more details. Well, one of the more details is, well, the hell with it, install anyway. I know that this is a secure program. I've been using it for years on one phone, and I've just downloaded it and installed it on the new phone, or I want to install it on the new phone. I know it's perfectly valid, so I'm quite happy to say install anyway, even though it's going to, you know, potentially put my device at risk. Install anyway. So again, very fairly quickly, it installs the phone, it says it's done, and here's iBird Pro running on the new phone, and everything is just dandy, almost. Because when I run the program, you can see in the background here, I've got a whole bunch of birds that I can get information about. But as soon as I click on one of them, I can't actually get any information. And it's that same problem again. If I was online on the internet, it could go look things up on the internet. But I like to have the database downloaded locally on the phone. And so here I'm trying to say, well, all right, go to the offline database and download this database for me. And I have to, again, I have to say, this is okay. I'm going to allow my app, this iBird Pro, to access photos and videos and all kinds of stuff. I'm going to allow that. However, even though I say allow it, you'll notice that I can't download it to the internal storage of the smartphone. And I also can't download it to an SD card that might be plugged into the phone. So I've got no way to actually download this file from the internet. Now, I'm not sure why that is. it's asking me to sign in with Google. If I say sign in with Google, that doesn't work either. It says the login failed. I give it some credentials and the login fails. I don't really know what's going on. I'm not sure if that means that this iBird Pro website is no longer live. It doesn't exist anymore. And the database just isn't there for me to download. Because if I try and, let's just say I want to know about all the flycatchers, it tells me I've got no internet access, and that's not true. A, because I can connect to the internet on Wi-Fi, but I can also set the data on my data plan and have direct access through the phone on the data plan. And neither of those things will give me access in this application. So I suspect it's the application that's got the problem, not my internet. So that is going to be a major stumbling block in terms of I've got the app now transferred. Now this is very specific to this application. If you had a regular program, an APK file, you just had a regular APK file, you transfer it to the phone, you install it, and it's basically going to work just as if you had downloaded the APK file from the Google Play Store. So this portion of the transferring a program from one device to a second device normally will work really well. And it's very simple, and it's not hard at all. My problem is very specific to iBird Pro and this local database. So I had to come up with a different solution, and I've talked enough about transferring programs tonight, so let's leave that until next time, and we'll take a look at how I got around this problem, because I think it's actually quite a useful application for other purposes, not just this one particular database file. Anyway, I have to do a bit more research on that, but I'll report on that later.
Very cool.
Okay.
Just before we move on, Stu mentions that an alternative to Google's Play Store, there's F-Droid and APK Pure, where you can also find other Android apps that Google no longer offers. So anybody who needs that, check that out.
Okay, all right. Next up, we have Chris, who's going to talk about multi-factor authentication.
Yeah, this is kind of interesting, I thought. Multi-factor authentication when you're talking about humans. And so, you know, we've talked about multi-factor authentication before when signing on to any online services. And typically the way it works is you provide your username and password, and then you'll get a one-time code sent to either your phone or email, or maybe it's through an authentication app on your phone or whatever. And then, you know, you might have to enter that code at the website in order to finalize and get onto the site. So that's sort of the basics of it. But what about when you're dealing with humans? Okay, so I sort of wondered, you know, could somebody call Service Ontario or my bank or cell phone provider or my insurance agent or anything else pretending to be me and then do something? You know, could they change my service? Could they transfer my phone number to another phone? Could they cancel my insurance, get other personal information about me? All of those sort of questions, you know, sort of interesting to think about whether somebody else could try to impersonate me. So, you know, the question is, how are callers authenticated when somebody just phones in? Now, I hope that all of the service providers have some way of authenticating who you are when you phone them. And I think a lot of the times they ask pretty simple stuff. You know, what's your address, phone number, birth date, things like that. Some of them might go a little bit further in terms of, like, if it's your bank, they might ask you what your balance is or your balance was at the end of last month, or, you know, other pieces of information that maybe are a little bit harder to come by. But, you know, the question really, you know, comes as, you know, can somebody find out this information? And so my thought is, if a provider offers a better way of doing the authentication, then I say take it. And this happened to me with Rogers. So I got an email from Rogers saying that they were offering to enable voice ID or set up a PIN so that only I can access my Rogers account when I phone them in, phone into the to get service or whatever. And they said, call us and speak to an agent. So I said, okay, yeah, that sounds like a good thing. Now, first off, I would say avoid voice ID. So they said they could do it either with voice ID or set up a PIN. And we've all read stories about how with AI, voices can be faked. And I would be afraid that Rogers might just totally depend on voice ID being 100% reliable, and they would not do any other checks. So I don't particularly like the idea of using voice ID. So I opted for the PIN. And so I talked to them, and they allowed me to set up a PIN. And at the same time, they asked for a secret question-answer pair. And so they gave me a number of questions that I could choose from, and I chose favorite subject at school. And I told them the answer to that is light bulb. And so this is something that I highly recommend that people, when they have these security-type questions, give a fake answer. Because if I had favorite subject at school, and say I was a math whiz, and somebody was trying to fake being me, and they got, you know, a customer service person say, oh, what was your favorite subject in school? They might guess, well, math, and then they would get in. So give a fake answer, total nonsense, and then record everything into your password manager. So in this case, the PIN number, and then that secret question answer pair. I've registered those or logged those in my password manager. So now I'm pretty certain that when I call into Rogers to get any sort of service, including canceling it, changing the phone number, moving a SIM to a different phone or things like that, I'm going to be asked for the PIN, and I'm going to be asked for that subject. And I think that it's going to be very difficult for people to actually fake it out and pretend they're me. By the way, don't try to contact Rogers. Even if you have my PIN, light bulb is not the answer that I actually gave them.
It's computer science, I know that.
So that's it. So again, if you have something where you call anywhere and you can get service, if they have something that will do better authentication to make sure it's really you, then I would say take advantage of it.
Oh, what? By the way, what's your PIN?
It's 9 alpha J period.
Capital 7.
Yeah.
Chris, what about your password manager? Excuse me, which one do you use?
And I use.
Have you had any worry about that being compromised?
I use KeePass. And I haven't had any worries about it being compromised because they've been in business for about 20 years. I have not heard of any instance where their encryption has been broken by people. I have a long and complex master password that I don't think anybody is going to be able to crack in any century nearby now. And so, yeah, I've been very happy with KeePass, and I have not had any concerns about it being compromised.
Okay, thanks.
Tom's noting that apparently some people had calls trying to get them to say yes. He says no doubt or later reviews.
Yeah.
So that's a good reason for not picking up the phone if you don't know who's calling. Just let it
that's
go to
right.
voicemail.
Yeah.
Okay.
I see a comment there of Bitwarden is good too, and that's a highly respected password manager as well. I do caution just very slightly on anybody who uses one that comes as part of a security suite, that a couple of them actually do include a password manager. If you use that and you put in your hundreds of passwords into it, and then you decide you want a different security suite, you may be faced with having to re-enter these hundreds of entries into another password manager. So I like the idea of a password manager being standalone and not tied to anything else, including an operating system. So KeePass is available for iPhones, iOS, the iMac, or Macintosh. It's available for Android. It's available for Linux. It's available for BlackBerry. So I like that idea that it's not tied to anything else, and I should be able to continue using this for the foreseeable future.
And for those of us who are dual booting, it uses the same database file in both Linux and Windows.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Well, as I said, I thought we would have time for questions, and guess what? We have time for questions. So if you have any questions that we haven't already covered or comments on things that we have covered, now is the time.
I'm going to speak up.
Go ahead.
Alan, going back to your bird app problems, I don't know if you've ever looked at it, but you might want to take a look at the Audubon bird apps. They were equally as good as the Merlin and eBird stuff, but they're Audubon, of course, is a non-for-profit, whereas Merlin and eBird, they're all tied to for-profit universities. So,
but the Merlin app is free, so it's not as though you
so is Audubon
spend any money on it.
So is Audubon, but you get begging letters from time to time. Yeah, but it's quite comprehensive. I don't know enough to be able to comment on it, but I just thought I'd throw it out there for you to think about.
But Audubon's dead.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, so is Latin.
So 4 years of Latin.
Justin
has... It's going to be carborundum.
Justin has an interesting comment in the chat that TurboTax is saying that they may no longer support Windows 10 starting next year, and he has no desire to trash perfectly computer and makes him wonder what applications will have problems in a few months. And I doubt very many of them will be a few months. I'm really surprised that TurboTax would actually come out and say that they're not going to support Windows 10, you know, 6 months after the support for Windows 10 has stopped. One thing I will say is that if you want support for Windows 10, applications running on Windows 10, avoid Microsoft because they're probably the most likely to actually stop supporting their apps under Windows 10 quite quickly. Whereas other vendors seem to go attack where they will support older versions of the operating system for a lot longer. And usually I've noticed in the past, years after the operating system itself is no longer supported. So it does surprise me that TurboTax is doing that so quickly. But yeah, I guess that's something we're going to have to watch for. Anybody who's on Windows 10, you know, having to deal with that idea that, you know, the latest version of the program just won't work on Windows 10 potentially.
I think it was more of the they didn't say they will not support, but they mentioned Windows 11, so that makes me wonder what they were saying. I've got a feeling it might be the government that might not allow to transmit income tax data if you don't have the latest Windows. So
I doubt that. That would really surprise me.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what it meant, but they didn't turn Windows 11, and I was wondering what were the implications of that, so, and to other applications also.
Yeah, I guess you won't know until next spring whether you go to TurboTax and they say, oh, sorry, we don't support Windows 10, so you can't install it. I don't know.
That might be a Canadian government requirement in the future, although I think it might be difficult because of that would be prioritizing a particular vendor.
Yeah, exactly.
Andrew, Sherita.
Really hard.
Hi. Should I be there before 9? Is there any possibility he'd be out earlier than that?
Sorry?
I think that's going to be a problem for programs like TurboTax, though, because it depends on having new forms every year. It's not just a question of the old executable still running. Are they going to fiddle around and not supply the new tax forms for the old program, that kind of stuff?
Well, typically you need a brand new program. Eh? It's not, you know, each year they come up with a completely new program for that tax year.
No.
Yeah, well, they would just change in and out modules and update the details as necessary according to the tax legislation.
I've been using Wealthsimple for the last while. Now, they don't have a downloadable program, which doesn't make me all that happy that I'm ending up storing my tax data on Wealthsimple's website. But it's free. Well, it's donationware, I guess. They say, oh, you can pay however much you want, and you can happily put in $0, and then we'll continue on. But I've been quite happy with that. I guess this is a little bit late in the year to actually be bringing up the subject, but maybe next winter we should actually approach this as well and say, you know, what are people using and what are they happy about and not happy about with various tax programs that are out there?
I've been using StudioTax, and it's locally born and supported.
Okay.
Just a quick word about the e-books from the library, Alan.
Yes, go ahead.
I think when you check an e-book out from the library, other people can't check that out until you check it back in. So I doubt very much that you're going to be able to download a copy to read offline, because I think once you check it out, you have to check it back in. So if you had an offline copy, that would like be the end of it. You know, do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, but the offline copy disintegrates after 21 days.
I see. Okay.
So they've got that covered. You can return it early, of course, but okay. If you don't return it, it basically deletes itself, sort of thing.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Moving along then, just to wrap up. Our upcoming presentations at the library, we were talking about armchair travel, and Linda is going to be presenting her presentation on British Columbia. That's tomorrow night at Centennial. And she's getting ready for the summer. If you want to know how to take better photographs on your vacation, then on Tuesday the 20th at the Ruth E. Dickinson branch, that presentation will happen. And if you want to know how to use AI tools effectively, then Chris has got a whole bunch of quick tips on the 23rd at Centerpoint. And again, you have to register through the library, so go to that link if you want to register for any of those presentations. And it also will list all of the other ones that Chris and Linda are giving in the not-too-distant future. Next week is our regular monthly meeting, so there won't be a Q&A session. We have Mark Schulman coming back from the Central Florida Computer Society. He gave a presentation a while back, which was really good, and this time he's giving his specialty topic. His real interest is in the use of computers in the moon landings, and his whole presentation next week is exactly that topic, computers to the moon. So if you have any interest in that, I think that's a not-to-be-missed type presentation.
All right.
Go ahead.
I'm just going to say, I'll bite. I'll be there next week.
So the question is next, what do you need to know about hardware and software and operating systems, applications? We always have a lot of different topics on the go every. Amazingly, we have a lot of different topics every week, it seems. But if there are things that we're missing, I know what I'm interested in, and Chris knows what he's interested in. But the question is, what are you interested in? So if you have things that we you'd like us to talk about, or find somebody to talk about, please send us a note and tell us what that's going to be. But the presentations won't be next week, because as I said, next week is a regular monthly meeting. There won't be a Q&A. So you have 2 whole weeks to think about what you'd like to hear about, what you'd like to ask about, and what you'd like to present as shared topics. As usual, just send us a note to suggestion box at opcug.ca, and we'll be happy to add you to the agenda. So thanks to everyone for tonight, all the presentations and all the questions, lots of good discussion on a number of things and suggestions, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, folks. Hope to see you out at the regular monthly meeting next week.